From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. The Biggest Loser is a show about sweat, intense effort, clean eating, and incredible transformations of people who often lose hundreds of pounds. But after the show ends and the contestants go home, the real struggle begins. For many, the weight comes back with a vengeance. Everything they lost, plus more. How? A new big study of Bigger Loser contestants explains why so many of them and the rest of us can't keep off the weight we've lost. This hour on Point, lessons in weight loss from The Biggest Loser, and later in the hour, the American culture of food with the author of the new book, Devoured. You can join us on air or online. Have you dropped weight only to gain it back again? Did you ever consider it was your physiology, your biology? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Vancouver is Kevin Hall. He's the lead researcher on the new Biggest Loser study and an investigator at the National Institute of Health, specializing in metabolism and obesity. Kevin Hall, nice to have you.
Hi, Jay. Nice to have thanks for having me.
All right. And with me from Charlotte, North Carolina is Sean Allgaier. He's a contestant on season 8 of The Biggest Loser. He lost 155 pounds. He gained it all back and more. Researchers followed him as part of this 6-year study. Sean, welcome. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So, Kevin Hall, this was a 6-year study of contestants who participated in this program. What did you discover about the physiology of obesity?
Right. So these folks, as you mentioned in the introduction, are participating in a very rapid and extreme weight loss program. And we were really interested in seeing how their biology is responding to those intense efforts. And so what we found was that actually at the end of the competition, after these folks had lost a dramatic amount of weight in a very quick amount of time, the number of calories that their body was burning just to sort of be at rest and maintain life, not accounting for the physical activity, went down dramatically. And the thing that we were very interested in was what happened 6 years later after this competition was over. We expected many of them had regained some of the weight, but we were interested in knowing, did their metabolism improve over that period of time, and how much of their weight that they regained was body fat, for example. And so 6 years later, to our surprise, their metabolism was still at the same level as it was after this dramatic weight loss, despite the fact that they'd regained a substantial amount. But on average, not everybody regained all of their weight.
So was it the rapid weight loss that made the difference here? I mean, if you lose weight more slowly, does that make a difference?
You know, I wish we knew the answer to that question. You know, we studied these folks. I think that this is probably the biggest slowing of metabolism that's been seen. Whether or not this translates to a more realistic or more reasonable slow weight loss that folks have been recommending for years is a good question. We don't know the answer to that.
So, what was most shocking, as I understand, is that researchers that as the weight increased, the metabolism did not recover, right? They never recovered that pre-weight state. Is that right?
Right. That's correct. So despite the fact that they'd gained weight, we would expect that their metabolic rate would go up, because as people who are heavier tend to have greater metabolic rates. That's something we've known for decades now. It's the very rare individual who has a genetically slow metabolism, for example. So these folks, when they started, before they started the Biggest Loser competition, you know, we measured their metabolic rate, and it was pretty much what you would expect for people of that very large size initially. And so after they lost the weight, we reassessed them to see if they were still burning a right number of calories for their new smaller size.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a little too low, actually quite a bit too low. And now that they've regained some of that weight, interestingly, their metabolic rate did not go up. So they're fighting this now slower metabolism in order to keep the weight off. And, you know, it's an important point to make that these folks, relatively speaking, even though they regained a substantial amount of weight, they're still maintaining, on average, a good chunk of weight loss, which is actually clinically beneficial for them. They're healthier than they were to start, but they're fighting this slower metabolism.
In fact, their bodies were actually intensifying the effort to get back to that original weight, right? That's the bottom line?
That's one of the interpretations. In fact, one of the interesting parts of the study is the folks who actually were most successful at keeping the weight off were continuing to experience the greatest metabolic slowing. Mm. And the folks who had regained most of their weight, their metabolism recovered the most, maybe not completely, but it did recover the most. So it's almost as if the harder you're trying to kind of maintain the weight loss, the body was pulling you back harder, but not completely. So that's our interpretation of the findings. Again, whether or not this applies to the more realistic sort of weight changes that one would expect with a more traditional program is questionable.
Sean Allgaier, how much weight did you lose?
Yeah, I lost 155 pounds during the filming and taping of the show. In total, I lost 200 pounds within a year. And so, it was pretty substantial.
And so what the researchers discovered when they tested you over these period of 6 years or so was that you were actually burning 458 fewer calories a day than you would expect for a man your size. So your metabolism had dramatically slowed down after you lost this incredible amount of weight and were trying to keep it off.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, after the show, I kept it off for several years, but I began to see, increase when I would focus more on my job and things that would happen with my family. I kind of got back into real life and did real life stuff. I wasn't working out 4 hours a day or 3 hours a day. And so I yo-yoed. I mean, I went up, I went down, and every time I went down, it would come back on faster. I mean, I'd lose 30 pounds or 20 pounds or something like that. I wouldn't do anything for a week, and I'd get back on the scale and go, how did that happen so quickly? It's a very real struggle that just feels impossible.
You say in the New York Times piece that when you learned the results of the study, it was kind of like hearing you have a life sentence. What did you mean by that?
You know, the life sentence thing was just along the lines of people like me, people experiencing weight issues, you're just going to have to find a new normal. And the new normal is you have to wake up and you have to take care of yourself. And that is what the life sentence is about. You can't just coast through and not do any sort of exercise or work. You can't blame it on your metabolism or blame it on the study or whatever. It just means that, I have to find a new way to make sure that I stay healthy and that I make good choices. And that's a big mountain to look at, to be honest with you. As a large person, I look at people that seemingly don't work out much or maybe they eat whatever they want and they don't look like they change, a pound. And it's like, that is so frustrating because everything I do, it translates into pounds on me. I mean, if I breathe heavy, I'll gain a pound, So it's like, it's one of those things where I have to work at it. I have to get a serious plan and actually do something with it.
Kevin Hall, the point of the study, dieters really are at the mercy of their bodies. I mean, it's not just a slower metabolism. They're actually hormonal changes that you saw going on. Tell us about leptin and how that affected metabolism.
Sure. So leptin is a hormone that's produced by the fat cells in the body, and it basically signals your brain as to how much food you should be eating, or how hungry you should be, or what your appetite is. And the lower that number of leptin is, the more hungry you will be. And so one of the surprises initially with the study was that these folks had appropriate levels of leptin to start for their very large size, but at the end of the weight loss competition, we could barely detect the amount of leptin in their blood. It's meaning that they're now likely to be very hungry. And that has recovered somewhat in the 6 year follow up and so that's some good news, I guess. But there's this double whammy essentially that these folks were experiencing a slow metabolism and these hormones that are dictating basically how hungry you are making you more hungry. So the body is fighting the weight loss. But I think that one of the things that Sean mentioned is absolutely true. It's people probably should not be thinking of, extreme amounts of weight loss. 5 to 10% of body weight change for overweight and obese people is actually clinically beneficial. You don't have to have Biggest Loser style weight loss to actually benefit your health. Physical activity is beneficial for your health independent of weight loss. And so one of the messages here is that you should do what you can to live a healthy lifestyle, and that may translate into changes in body weight. It hopefully will, but you don't have to target huge amounts of weight loss like was targeted.
Well, but and the bottom line as well, you know, this is not a pathological lack of willpower. I mean, there's biology here, there's physiology that's involved.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, but the biology is not destiny either, and I think these folks actually are demonstrating that. 6 years later, on average, they're maintaining more than 10% weight loss, and that's actually great news for these folks. 6 years later, none of them became type 2 diabetic. They've actually done an amazing job and should be applauded for the, even though they regained a substantial amount of that weight initially, they're doing quite well.
Sean Allgaier, have you changed any of your habits to manage this slower metabolism, this change that seems to be permanent in your body?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so I do exercise a little bit here and there. I don't as much as I used to, but I have changed my eating habits. Before any of this happened, you know, I didn't care what I ate, but now having the knowledge that I learned at Loser, which was incredible knowledge. You know, I read labels. I look at what is in things. You know, I try to make great choices based off of what's in front of me. But I got to say this: back when I was on Loser, we cut out our cable to shop at Whole Foods because that was the best, you know, food. And now I can't do that. So I have to make do with what I have, and so it's a struggle there.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at a new study showing that after we have lost weight, our bodies fight to gain it back. You can join the conversation. Do we need to think more about the way we manage metabolism, not just the calories? Here is Sean Allgaier weighing in during season 8 of the finale of The Biggest Loser. This is host Allison Sweeney announcing the results. Sean Allgaier is with us this hour, as is Kevin Hall in Vancouver. He's the lead researcher on the new Biggest Loser study and an investigator at the National Institute of Health specializing in metabolism and obesity. Also with us now is Gina Colata, science and medicine correspondent for The New York Times. Nice to have you with us, Gina.
Thank you. It's so great to be on the show. Thanks.
So tell us about this study and its biggest takeaway in your mind.
I think the biggest takeaway was having the Biggest Losers have this result had an impact on people that almost nothing else would, because people saw them. They saw the before and afters. The weight loss was so dramatic. No one could say that these people were unmotivated. No one could say they didn't care. These are people who cared probably more than anyone you'd ever know. And look how hard they worked. And if they gained the weight back, then it tells you that it is not all the weight back. But if they gained a lot of the weight back, I think it told me and other people just how hard it is to maintain a weight loss. That it's not just a matter of saying, I think I'll make better food choices and exercise every day. These people did everything right, and the weight came back. So I think it brought home in a way nothing else ever could have, that this is as Sean was saying, this is like a life sentence. It's something you have to struggle with the rest of your life, because if you try to lose that, if you try to keep your weight off, the weight off, your body's going to fight back.
Here's the season 8 winner of The Biggest Loser. I want to ask you about Danny Cahill. Here he is talking about being on the show, what it taught him.
The Biggest Loser isn't just about losing the weight. The Biggest Loser is about healing what's wrong, because it's all for nothing.
if I win The Biggest Loser and go back to that nightmare. It's all for nothing, and that's not going to happen.
So Danny's story is interesting as well, Gina. I mean, his regimen was stunning. Waking up at 5 o'clock in the morning, treadmill for 45 minutes, a breakfast, you know, getting on the treadmill again, riding a bike 9 miles to the gym, working out for 2.5 hours. I mean, it goes on and on and on. Is that the sort of level of extreme exercise that we're talking about here for changes in physiologically and biologically in your body when that happens? You just, there's nothing else you can do.
Well, what he was trying to do when he had that incredible regimen, I mean, I don't know how he could keep that up at all. He was trying to lose weight. They sent everybody home for a couple months and said, now do it on your own and come back for the finale. And he wanted to lose as much weight as he possibly could before the finale. So his goal was to have a caloric deficit of 3,500 calories a day, which he thought would translate into a pound a day of lost weight. Then when the show was over, he made it his career to be The Biggest Loser. He was a motivational speaker. He wrote a couple of books. And it was his job, really, to keep the weight off. And he would exercise not that much, but a lot. And he was watching his diet very, very carefully. After a couple of years, he went back to his normal job, and he didn't have enough time in his life to exercise like that. It was impossible. So the weight started creeping on. And so I think the lesson that he learned and other people learned is it's not his fault. He's burning 800 calories, fewer calories a day than would be expected for a man his size. So he says it's like a meal and a half. He says, like, I'm two-thirds of a person. But he said it kind of explains a lot. It explains why he goes out with his friends and everybody's eating and having fun, and he does what they do, and all of a sudden he said, there goes 20 pounds. So it explains why it's such a struggle for him. And he said he was so ashamed, and other people told me that too. They were so ashamed because the whole world had seen them on that stage. People told them, yeah, "You're our hero. We admire you so much. We're going to do what you did." And then when the weight comes back, he told me some people said they wish they could move to another town where nobody knew them because everybody thinks, "What's wrong with them? They lost all that weight. Why did it come back?" He says, now the shame is going away for him because he and everybody understands. He tries. He's still trying. He's still working at it.
Still working at it.
But that's unreasonable, yeah, to what he was doing before.
That's Gina Kolata, science and medicine reporter for The New York Times. This is her new piece, After the Biggest Loser, Their Bodies Fought to Regain Weight. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Here's a comment from our website from Dr. Susan Roberts from the USDA Nutrition Center at Tufts University. She said, the media representation of this new Biggest Loser study is wildly inappropriate. It is a study of 14 individuals who went through a bizarre and unsustainable regimen to lose weight. My colleagues and I at Tufts have conducted two studies of changes in metabolic rate with weight loss in 175 people. So if you lose 10% weight, your body needs approximately 10% fewer calories to maintain weight, so no drastic changes. The Biggest Loser is entertaining, but in my opinion is almost irrelevant to most people trying to lose weight and keep it off by sensible, healthy approaches. Kevin Hall, you worked on this study. What's your response to Dr. Roberts there?
I think that she has a number of excellent points. I think that when you're targeting a more reasonable weight loss, like 10%, and you're doing it over a reasonable time frame, there's very limited evidence that you get this kind of metabolic slowing. It does happen. She does acknowledge that metabolism goes down, hunger goes up. So that aspect of what we're talking about here is in common with everyday programs. I think what the issue here is that, you know, these folks who are starting off as being very heavy, stigmatized horribly in our society, and they're trying to normalize their weight. They're trying to bring it down to basically levels that no one would ever know that they had been that heavy in the past. And from a health perspective, that's not required. What's required is the sort of modest weight loss, 5%, 10% of body weight, that is potentially sustainable for forever as long as you continue to sustain those lifestyle changes. So I think that she has many excellent points. What we were interested in, you know, we weren't involved in The Biggest Loser television program. We were scientists. I saw saw these dramatic weight losses, and I wanted to know, would you actually intervene in this extreme way? How does the body fight back? And that was the purpose of this study. It's not to basically say that everybody experiences this dramatic slowing of metabolism or this dramatic increase in hunger or these dramatic decreases in hormones like leptin, but those same changes happen, just not to the same magnitude.
Let's get some callers in here. Mike in Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Mike. Glad you called. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, fine. Go ahead.
I can only speak from my personal experience. About 10 years ago, I was at about 300 pounds. I've been as low as the 190s. I've stabilized at 210. But what did it for me was saying I have to make the lifestyle changes to get to where I wanted to be. And what that means for me is every day I do 6 miles a day, 6 to 7 days a week. I regiment my meals. I make the sacrifices. And you know what? There's not a day that goes by that I say, boy, I would really love some Rumory's and ice cream. Boy, I would really love some fast food. But those are the sacrifices that I make to stay where I have to be. And it requires discipline and pain and suffering. And it is a lifelong thing, but you have to adjust your lifestyle to meet your fitness goals and not vice versa. I'm living that.
Mike, thank you.
I live it every day.
Thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it. Let's go to Sean in New Orleans, Louisiana. Hi, Sean. Welcome.
Hey, Jane. Yeah, I just had a quick question. Because I think I've gotten caught in this cycle of, like, you know, crash diets, and it's actually making a lot of sense. What I was wondering is, would it be better to maybe, like, get, like, a baseline calorie intake of where I'm at right now, make healthier decisions to keep those calories that I eat every day, and then go to, like, you know, more aerobic activity, exercise, and not, you know, try and take big chunks out of my diet every day? Does that make sense?
Yeah, Sean, thank you. Your response, Kevin Hall?
You know, I'm not a medical doctor. I don't give personal advice to people. But what I would say is that whatever lifestyle changes that you can make that are permanently going to improve your health, changes in diet, eating more whole foods, changes in physical activity, not necessarily doing the extreme exercise that the previous caller did, but just becoming more active, those should be the focus. And that will improve your health. You know, we shouldn't be so focused on the cosmetics of weight loss, of trying to look better. We should be trying to feel better. We should be trying to change your life in a sustainable way that's going to actually improve your health, improve your life, essentially. Mm-hmm. And I think that should be the real goal here.
Here's another Biggest Loser winner. After losing 112 pounds, she was the first woman to win the season. Allie Vincent struggled to gain, to keep the weight off. She left the show in 2008, and here she is in an interview in late May.
I was ashamed. I was just ashamed. I was embarrassed. I was like, I don't know. I just, I don't know. It was a low point. It was like probably my lowest point. I won the Biggest Loser. You know, I was the first female to win the Biggest Loser. Like, I'm Allie Vincent. Like, I'm supposed to be strong. I'm supposed to know how to do this. I do know how to do it. Like, I do know what I need to do.
Sean Allgaier, you've been there. You lost the weight. You gained it back. But you actually say in the New York Times piece that, you know, you're in a really good place right now.
Yeah. So the idea that you're on this stage and you want to lose this weight and you want to make sure everybody's proud of you and you become this hero, kind of like what you said, if you let that creep into your head and you let that just live in your soul, basically it just runs you. And that's what your motivation is. It makes you want to get up and lose weight and that kind of thing. But I actually did some counseling and some other things like that. And I promote that. I promote counseling. See a counselor. Go to a program. Do something. Talk about it. Get it out. But I was able to go through some counseling and get to a really, really good place in my soul. And I don't wake up every day going, I have to make everybody proud. I have to do this for them. I wake up and I say, okay, what's the next right choice? What's the next right thing for me? What's the next right thing I can eat? What's the next right thing I can do to be healthy? I work out with my buddy Brad. I work out with my friend. You know, it's just that and the other.
Your routine. Yeah.
Yes. And it's all about staying healthy and whole inside of you.
Let's go back to the phones. Mark in Strong, Maine. Thanks for waiting, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I think this has been talked about already, but about 25 years ago, I lost 30 pounds, went from about 205, 210 down to 170. And I did it over probably about a year, year and a half. And, you know, through just lifestyle change, diet, exercise, and so on. And I've been able to maintain that pretty much for the past 25 years. And I'm wondering, is it reasonable to expect if you lose a lot of weight in a short amount of time like that, that you're going to be able to maintain that? Is that a reasonable expectation?
Mm-hmm. Mark, thanks so much. We talked a little bit about this, Kevin Hall, but talk about the weight maintenance and the weight loss and how those things are different. Are they separate issues?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, one of the things that when people target very large amounts of weight loss that they want to do in a very rapid period of time, the changes that they're going to have to make to their lifestyle to meet those targets, very much like what happened for these Biggest Loser folks, are not sustainable. And so you're basically trying to change your life in an unsustainable way to meet some goal over a relatively short period of time. And we know that that lifestyle is not sustainable with continued life, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, how does one learn what lifestyle to do in order to then maintain that weight loss? And that's the difficult question. And so what your caller is suggesting is that maybe if you just target the lifestyle change that you're willing to do and then lose the weight slowly, maybe that might be more successful. I think that that's an interesting question. Some more recent data that have come out have suggested that the folks who do better in the long term are the folks who lose the most weight. But again, I don't think that we're talking about the same sorts of big changes over very rapid periods of time like the Biggest Loser folks experienced.
Gina Colata, how does this study change our understanding, broadly speaking, of obesity?
I think it expands on and makes a point in a very dramatic way that obesity is not just a matter of somebody deciding they're going to eat a bunch of donuts for breakfast and a bunch of, I don't know, fast food junk for lunch, and it's their own fault if they just ate like a normal person and exercise modestly. They too would be thin. It shows that there are controls the body has, and different people sort of win the genetic lottery or lose the genetic lottery, but different people are going to have harder or easier times keeping the weight off. And I think there's nothing like a study like this to sort of show people, bring it really, really bring it home to them that your weight and your struggle to maintain a weight is not necessarily just due to how much willpower you do or don't have.
Kevin Hall, wrap us up here. I mean, add to that. Is this a disability of a malfunctioning metabolic system, not simply a food addiction?
Well, I think that Gina makes an important point. Genetics plays a huge role in this basic lottery of who is, in some sense, more susceptible to the changes in the environment that have driven obesity in the past 30 years. And what we need to do is we need to figure out what's going on with the biology that these people are experiencing in order to better help them in the future. And it's studies like this, where there might be extreme and not translatable to everybody who's doing weight loss, where we can better understand what are the biological forces that these folks are facing and how can we learn from that and with research intervene in the future in order to actually make it easier for people to lose weight and keep it off over the long term.
Sean Allgaier, contestant on The Biggest Loser, you lost 155 pounds. You gained more of it back. Would you do this all again in our last 30 seconds here?
Absolutely, absolutely. The stuff I learned there, I take with me today, and I blame nothing on them. I learned nothing but good things. But yeah, it is about a new normal.
Sean Allgaier is from The Biggest Loser, contestant on Season 8, participant there, and in this Big Loser study. Sean, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Kevin Hall is a lead researcher on the new Biggest Loser study as well, and an expert in metabolism and obesity in the National Institute of Health. Kevin, thanks so much for your time and your insights. We really appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
And Gina Colata, science and medicine reporter at The New York Times. Her piece is After the Biggest Loser, Their Bodies Fought to Regain Weight. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Gina, thank you very much. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you. A really interesting show. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. When we come back, the new book, Devoured, From Chicken Wings to Kale Smoothies, How What We Eat Defines Who We Are. It's a deep look at the culture of food and eating in the United States. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. There are certain truths about American eating that seem all too familiar. The sad desk lunch, skipping breakfast, the rise of gluten-free dining. These are just a few of the pieces of vast, complicated culture of American food. That culture is the subject of a new book called Devoured, From Chicken Wings to Kale Smoothies, How What We Eat Defines Who We Are. Love to have you join our conversation here. What are you devouring? How much do you worry about fast food, healthy food, about making time to sit down for a proper meal? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me from San Francisco is Sophie Egan, Program Director at the Culinary Institute of America and contributor to the New York Times Well blog. Her new book is Devoured, From Chicken Wings to Kale Salads, How What We Eat Defines Who We Are. And you can find an excerpt at our website, as well as some of Sophie's favorite recipes. Sophie Egan, welcome. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. It's great to be here.
Well, you weave together in a terrific way insights from the field of psychology and anthropology and food science and marketing and behavioral economics. To give us a headline from your research, what would it be? How do you characterize the American food culture?
Broadly speaking, American food culture is full of contradictions. Some of the things that have been true about us from our earliest days, from our founding, are that we eat on the run, the old adage, you know, dine and dash. A European traveler visiting the United States in the 1800s even suggested gobble, gulp, and go as our national motto. And one of the most fascinating things I found was that compared to all the other developed countries, we spend not only the least time in the United States cooking food, but actually eating food. So that's certainly one of the most prominent traits that define our eating culture, but also our individualism. Whether we realize it or not, we share an affinity for that old Burger King slogan, have it your way. You know, there are 87,000 different drink combinations at Starbucks. We like to personalize and customize our eating. But we're also very open-minded as a culture of eaters. We like to try new things. And to me, that's really one of our greatest traits.
You write in the book about the quest for convenience. It has created a, I think you called it a muddle of the modern meal. Tell us what you mean by that.
Absolutely. So one of the things that surprised me most was this social experiment that we're all engaging in related to snacking. Most of us now snack at least 2 to 3 times a day, and some people are snacking, are eating up to as frequently as every 2 hours. It's become not only socially acceptable, but socially normal.
But I thought it was good for us, right? I thought we were supposed to keep our hunger down, keeps the metabolism steady, all of that.
Right. So this is definitely one of the drivers of this way of eating. You know, it's considered grazing. These small meals spread throughout the day has been promoted by some nutritionists as being better for metabolism. But it's the difference between, intention and reality, which is that most of us are adding those snacks to what meals we would already eat as opposed to supplementing. So it means that we're actually eating more total than we used to. And as I said, it's this social experiment because there aren't really the social rules or cultural norms of what's reasonable to that are because of how new this is. So it's too soon to really know, but it's definitely one of the more surprising elements of our daily lives is how frequently we're eating throughout the day.
So we're snacking a lot. It's gobble, gulp, go, as you say, dining and dashing. We're also eating lunch at our workplaces more. You talk about desktop dining, that 40% of us eat lunch at our desks at work. Stephen Colbert made fun of this in a series where he films himself eating lunch at work. And here's that.
What better way to bond with you guys than over lunch? After all, these days, a lot of people eat their lunch alone at their desks, watching videos like these. Let's see what I got in here today. I'm trying to drop a few LBs before September 8th, so I'm practicing portion control. I'm only eating small-sounding foods. Oh, I got Little Caesars, a box of Thin Mints, and, ooh, baby back ribs.
What's the problem with the sad desk lunch, would you say, Sophie Egan?
Yeah, so the problem is really related to what's being called mindful eating. You know, when you're eating at your lunch, you have a sense that you're still being productive because you're staring at your screen. You're, you know, probably crumbs spewing all over your keyboard. And that means that you're sort of distractedly eating, but you're not really focused on your work and you're not really focused on your eating. It also means you might be eating, you know, some things that are one-handable. Maybe you're using your mouse with the other hand, and that often probably leads to more kind of processed foods or packaged foods and things like that. So, and from a mental health standpoint, the irony is that it actually really boosts your productivity to take a break. And I share some of that research in the book, but this kind of death of the lunch break as a norm in work culture is a real problem because it means we are many of us are just not focusing on food at any point during the day. It's, you know, many of us, only 26% of us actually eat breakfast every day. So it's this hectic pace of the workday where you're squeezing in a snack here, a Kind bar there, a trail mix wherever you can, and really not taking the time to eat in a way that's more intentional, that really is more about a food experience. And it's when you're eating at your desk, you're eating alone. More of us are eating alone today than ever before, and that has real problems in terms of what you might be eating and also how quickly you might be eating.
Some listeners with some questions for you, Sophie Egan. Here's Paula in Roscommon, Michigan. Paula, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hi, Jean.
Hi.
I'm wondering, I've heard more and more about good fats versus ordinary fat, and I'm wondering if that's something like salad should have more avocados or, you know, should we really be cooking more with coconut oil and olive oil and maybe pour more olive oil on that salad? Is that, you know, I'm hearing more and more about this. Is that, what's your thoughts?
Paula, thanks. Yeah. A new craze out there, Sophie. What do you say?
What I would say is actually to sort of share what I'm more interested in, which is why the caller is asking about these fats in the first place. And that's really this cultural norm in the United States of looking at food in a way that's very nutrient centric. You know, right now protein is like the macronutrient du jour, but fat has kind of gone in and out of favor. And it really stems from the way that broadly speaking, as Americans, we look at food in terms of sort of tallies of this or that thing that we want to load up on or avoid at all costs, as opposed to the kind of inherent value of whole fresh foods in themselves, as well as the food experience. So, you know, I really can't speak to those specific ingredients, and certainly some foods are healthier than others. But I, in this book, really encourage us to look more at what's driving our food, our relationship to food, in the way that we look at its value. I have a whole chapter actually on selling absence and talk a lot about labels of low fat or reduced fat, and look at foods more for the joy and the pleasure they can bring, for the sensory aspects of a food experience. And some of that certainly can come back to which foods make us feel better. And that may be, in the case of the caller's question, maybe you feel better when you eat avocados.
We just heard a lot about the physiology of weight loss. And, you know, we think maybe of dieting as a modern phenomenon, but you take us back in this book through some crazy diets of history, back as far as the Greeks and the Romans. It's not just the American diet that is big and hip now, vegan, paleo, gluten-free, whatever it may be. Talk to us about the history, the historical aspect of this.
Sure, yes. Yeah. So this definitely does go back centuries, but in the U.S. in particular, we've seen a pretty riotous list of strategies. You know, people have tried, you know, all water diets, or there's rubber underwear that will make you sweat all your fat off. There are, you know, we've seen corsets, which of course make it, ironically to me, corsets made it harder to move, which was in theory, you know, the best way to to get rid of whatever it was that you were trapping inside there. But the throughout history, we've seen a variety of extremes, things that are even close to sort of poison, you know, arsenic and the like. Mm.
Brandy in Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Brandy. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. I just had a comment to make. First, let me say that my family and I, over the past year, have lost a grand total of about 300 pounds. And we didn't count any calories. We didn't worry about what time of day we ate, anything like that. We try to keep the foods whole, keep them in their natural state. We don't worry about, like I said, the time of day. Fasting, I think, is a great way just to help to heal your body. But you just really want to keep the food as whole and as clean as possible and eat what you need for your body to sustain a healthy body.
It's a great point, Brandy. Thank you. If you can't pronounce it, don't eat it, right? I hear what you're saying, Brandy. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Sophie Egan, you have a chapter in your book called Stunt Foods, where you illustrate how social media has contributed to our food culture, to things like the Burger King bacon sundae, an amalgamation that Americans, only Americans would eat, right? Talk about that.
Sure. And it really goes to the caller's comment, which is this tendency in the past to kind of feel a need to try the latest novelty food, these stunt foods. You mentioned the bacon sundae, but I had a whole section exploring the Doritos Locos Taco from Taco Bell. That's that neon orange hard taco that many of you may have seen because it sold in record-breaking numbers. We actually collectively ate 100 million of them in 10 weeks.
Here's an ad for that, the Doritos Locos Taco. It's the most popular fast food in history. Here it is.
It's finally here, a taco supreme in a shell made of real nacho cheese Doritos. And yes, it's everything you dreamed it could be. The new Doritos Locos Tacos.
To that point, Sophie Egan, there it was. It's sold more than anything.
Right,
exactly. So what about that? What draws us to that? Is it the layering of the food, the salt, the fat, the sugar? I mean, it just appeals to us physiologically. We respond to it from a very basic level.
Well, that the combination there in terms of the salt, sugar, and fat has been written in, you know, a terrific book by Michael Moss and speaks to the kind of drug-like qualities of those different combinations. But in my book Devoured, I talk about actually this thing called an experiential resume, where as Americans we have a productivity orientation where we really strive to sort of have a lot to show for our time on Earth, and that means the same way we might collect baseball cards or shot glasses, we try to collect experiences. And things like these stunt foods, once you have sort of taken a picture of you know. Drinking a shamrock shake, you have now obtained that experience in your, you know, kind of bucket list. And it can be fun and it can make you sort of feel like you're living a full life. But the problem from a marketing standpoint is it's like the real world equivalent of clickbait. You know, it's stuff you would never normally put in your body, but it gives this sense of a false scarcity. Like, if you don't hurry in now and get this limited time only thing, your life will be incomplete. And that can cause a lot of stress and also lead us to eat some things that are, you know, most of these stunt foods are frankly, you know, nutritional train wrecks where we're not going to be feeling too great. Mm.
You also write in the book that because Americans are outsourcing the making of their food to professionals more, that we're headed toward a losing food literacy altogether, that an entire generation, you know, may not know how to cook an egg or chop an onion or, heaven forbid, roast a chicken, right? Is that a real danger to your mind based on your research for this book?
Absolutely. I am concerned about that. And a big part of it is this, you know, people tend to, and this came up earlier in the show about it's not, you know, we just shift away from sort of blaming people and blaming individuals, you know, oh, people are so lazy, that's why they don't cook. And I see it really more as a lack of confidence in the kitchen. Most people, these skills, kind of a an intimacy with food, with the feelings of food. How do different flavors go with each other? How do you, you know, how to chop an onion, as I mentioned? How do foods change over time or different temperatures? These aren't being passed on in the same ways that they used to be. So we don't sort of feel equipped to prepare foods for ourselves. And therefore, we're more reliant on these other, on professionals. So you see more prepared foods in grocery stores. You see delivery apps and so on. And I'm also concerned from a food literacy standpoint, not just with the cooking, but culturally, we really don't place much of an emphasis on food. Mm. And to me, a big part of that comes down to the amount of time. You look at K-12 schools. You can't give children 10 minutes to scarf down a hot dog and think that they're going to go through life feeling that food is important or that they really understand food. So there's a big disconnect there to me in terms of what we want the outcome to be, but also the skills and the time that we're allocating culturally to it.
Here's a clip from the 2009 film Julie and Julia. Julie, played by Amy Adams, is a young New Yorker who cooks her way through Julia Child's cookbook, Mastering the Art of French Cooking. Here she explains why she loves cooking to her husband Eric, played by Chris Messina.
You know what I love about cooking?
What's that?
I love that after a day when nothing is sure, and when I say nothing, I mean nothing, you can come home and absolutely know that if you add egg yolks to chocolate and sugar and milk, it will get thick. It's such a comfort.
Despite everything, it is a good one. Despite everything you've said here, Sophie Egan, at the end of the book, you write that there is nowhere else I'd rather be an eater than in America. Why is that?
Yes, it is true. And I didn't want to give the wrong impression because there is so much about our food culture already to celebrate. And a big part of that, as I mentioned at the beginning, is how open-minded we are. And so on the one hand, we don't have what's considered a stable food culture or as many traditions, perhaps, but it means that we welcome it all, throw it all into the pot, you know, the melting pot. So we get fusion cuisine, which sometimes gets a bad rap, but produces all kinds of culinary creativity that you don't get to experience anywhere else. So I'm a fan of Korean tacos, naan pizza, and the rest.
Oh, sounds good. Sophie Egan, thank you so much for your time. Author of Devoured, From Chicken Wings to Kale Smoothies, How We Eat Defines Who We Are. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up tomorrow, we speak with Leslie Stahl on her favorite assignment, being a grandma. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.